Well, tonight, the skeptic's cage. Two go in, one comes out. Who will it be? Stanton Friedman, the ufologist, or Dr. Michael Shermer, the skeptic? Well, that's next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, two guests for you. Stanton Friedman, he received his B.S. and M.S. degrees in physics from the University of Chicago in 1955 and 56, where Carl Sagan was a classmate. He worked for 14 years as a nuclear physicist for such companies as General Electric, General Motors, Westinghouse, TRW, Aerojet, General Nucleonics, and McDonnell Douglas on such advanced, highly classified, eventually canceled projects such as nuclear aircraft fission and fusion rockets. Since 1967, he has lectured on the topic of UFOs. He's been all over the country, all over the world. Stanton Friedman was with me and Michael Shermer on the Larry King Show a few weeks ago. Hey, Stanton, how are you?
Well, it's a good morning here. I figured out some puzzles. I'm happy.
Well, it's good to have you with us. And Dr. Michael Shermer, of course, is the founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine. He's the director of the Skeptic Society, a monthly columnist for Scientific American, the host of the Skeptic's Distinguished Science Lecture Series at the California Institute of Technology. He also edits Skeptic.com. Dr. Shermer received his BA degree in psychology from Pepperdine University, his MA in experimental psychology from California State University, and his PhD in the history of science from Claremont Graduate University. He, too, is with us on Coast to Coast. Hello, Michael. Welcome
back. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good to have you both with us. And, of course, when we were on the Larry King Show, Stanton and Michael were in the corner swinging at each other. I had to break it up. Only kidding, guys. Only kidding.
Throwing chairs.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Michael, how did you have a good time on the King Show? What'd you think?
Oh, those shows are always frustrating because they're fairly short and everybody talks over one another. I found one of the most amusing things was emails I got days afterwards from fellow skeptics who said, the other guys kept talking over you. How come you weren't more aggressive? And then from UFO people had said, how come you kept interrupting the UFO people? You were so rude.
And too aggressive.
So we all filter these things through our own biases, I think.
Stanton, how about you? What kind of a time did you have on the King Show?
Well, it was a frustrating is a good word for it. Too many people, no chance to finish thoughts. I got asked why the cover-up. I said there are six reasons in the article on my website, and I gave one, and suddenly we were someplace else. It was frustrating, and, you know, it's not a good way to get at truth when you got so many people talking so quickly on such a diverse collection of topics. You know, I admire Buzz Aldrin, but I didn't think a lesson on how the rocket works was, you know, very useful.
And that was going to go on and on and on, too.
Yes.
Well, tonight what we'll do is we'll have a friendly discussion on why, Stanton, you believe in the existence of UFOs, and you, Michael, why you believe that we don't. But you look at things as, are you a debunker or a skeptic? There's a big difference, Michael.
Yeah, big difference. Skepticism is just a tool. It's not a thing. It's not a position you take. I don't think of it as a noun. I think of it more as a verb, that it's just a way of analyzing claims. You can be skeptical of a claim. You can be skeptical of the skeptics. Global warming certainly comes to mind. There are people that are skeptical of global warming, and there are people that are skeptical of the so-called global warming skeptics. And that's a nice example, I think, of a current event that shows it really is just a way of analyzing claims, and people can differ on how they use the tool. So in the case of UFOs and SETI and so forth, you know, it isn't a position to take. There's, you know, several different questions to ask. Are they out there? Have they come here? What is the quality of the evidence for each of the different kinds of claims? And you have to take them one at a time, and it would be obviously dogmatically closed-minded to say, well, I just don't believe, period. You don't believe what? I mean, what, you know, you have to take them one claim at a time. And that's what we try to do at Skeptic with all the different things, like alternative medicine. I mean, there's thousands of claims. You can't just say, I don't believe any of them. You have to, you know, look at each one of them.
Well, we've got a lot of time on this program, unlike Larry had. So let us start with you, Stanton, and I'll just give you a moment of opening remarks on why you're a believer.
Well, I'm not a believer. I'm a scientist who's been looking at the data for 49 years, been lecturing about it for 40 years, which gives me plenty of feedback. It's overall evidence that Michael never deals with, and I actually figured out tonight why he makes extraordinary claims, like that there's that only anecdotal evidence, for example, or no security aspect of this, and I figured all that out. Basically, I've reached four major conclusions. One, the evidence is overwhelming that planet Earth is being visited by intelligently controlled extraterrestrial spacecraft. In other words, some, underlined 37 times, some UFOs are alien spacecraft, most are not. Don't care about them. Secondly, that we're dealing with a cosmic Watergate, meaning some few people within the major governments of the planet have known since at least 1947 when two craft were recovered in southeastern New Mexico, alien craft and alien bodies, that indeed some UFOs are alien spacecraft. The third conclusion is that there are no good arguments against a flying saucer reality, against the first two conclusions, only people who haven't looked at the evidence. Such as Michael. And fourth, we're dealing with the biggest story of the millennium. Not two millennia, one millennium. Visits to planet Earth by alien spacecraft, successful cover-up of the best data bodies and wreckage for 60 years. That's quite remarkable. So that, in a nutshell, is where I stand. And in my lectures, of course, I go through evidence. Now, we don't have time for me to present a bunch of slides, even if I hold them close to the telephone, you won't see them. So we'll deal with evidence as we go along and my solution to why Michael makes extraordinary claims, and we'll get on with
it. All right. And Michael, why are you the skeptic?
Well, again, I separate the two major questions. Are extraterrestrial intelligences out there somewhere in the cosmos, and have they come here? And obviously the answer to the first question is nobody knows. We have to keep looking, listening, searching, sending out spacecraft, using radio telescopes and so on, like the SETI program does. And like most of the SETI scientists, I would say, you know, it would be remarkable if we were alone. I mean, as Carl Sagan liked to say, you know, what a considerable waste of space. And it would be rather egocentric and narrow-minded of us to think that we're special, we're alone. You know, the Copernican principle here applies, that we're not special, that if it happened here, it likely happened elsewhere. The raw numbers by themselves, the, you know, 100 billion galaxies and 100 billion stars in each one of them, and let's say only 10%, but probably more, have planets, mm-hmm. You just end up with a probability of close to one that there has to be extraterrestrial intelligence somewhere out there. And I'm not talking just about bacterial-grade life, but actual intelligence.
So you believe that?
Yeah, believe it. Okay, that's a
tricky word. That's my favorite word.
I think it's highly probable, although we have no evidence of it yet, so we have to just keep looking.
But you don't believe
I'm here. No, I think there's a lot of good arguments against the idea that they've come here, and if they have, they wouldn't resemble anything like what you typically see in the narratives of alien abduction experiences and those sorts of things, where there are bipedal primates that are bilaterally symmetrical with two arms and two legs and a head and two eyes and so forth. That, I mean, that only happened once in the, you know, 4 billion year history of Earth and of the trillions of species that have evolved and gone extinct. Only one lineage has become bipedal primates, us. And so the idea that that happened somewhere else is pretty improbable, and that they then happened to find us in the, you know, vast emptiness of the cosmos, that makes it seem even more unlikely. And therefore the terrestrial hypothesis that people are having psychological experiences, sleep disorders, hallucinations, illusions, their creative, fantasy-prone personalities, whatever, concocting stories of aliens that look like us, that seems more probable than the previous scenario.
Last hour of the program, when we go to phone calls, so we would have had 2 hours of this debate. I'll open up the fast blasts, and we'll have listeners vote without trying to skew anything. We'll just take them as they come in on who they felt won tonight's Skeptics Cage debate. I remember, Stanton, when you did the first one with Seth Shostak, you won, did you not?
Well, it was 57-33-10. I didn't get a prize, though, George.
No, the prize has not come yet. The prize actually will be doing a full show with you on your Betty Hill book.
Okay.
How about that?
I can put up with that as a prize. I mean, I've read the book. I don't think, Michael, has Michael read the book?
I don't know.
No,
if you had it with you, right?
Betty Hill book.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to break down tonight's debate in different areas and concepts. And Michael, you basically have started the first one for us, and that is there's no question that this universe has billions of planets in there, and that the possibility of life out there is pretty strong. Let's address that first and foremost, not whether we've been visited or not, but life out there. Stanton, of course, being the scientist who believes in visitation, obviously then you're the believer in life out there elsewhere. But I want you to elaborate, as a scientist, why you believe there are many planets out there inhabited by intelligent beings.
Well, you know, I can't come to a conclusion as to how many are inhabited by intelligent beings. Unlike Michael, I don't think it's probable or improbable. When you don't have data, you might as well throw darts at a dartboard. The simple fact of the matter is there are bipedal beings coming here. Now, how many planets out there have life? We don't know. We do have to take into account, though, that the distribution of life, even on our planet, is related to things like colonization and migration. So if it starts at one place, it could move on all over the place. And we don't know. It's like SETI. You know that I've said that SETI is like silly effort to investigate, because when you look at the Drake equation, there's no way to put in numbers. We don't know what fraction of planets develop life. We don't know what fraction of those develop intelligence, or what fraction of those send signals. It's not an equation. There's no way to put numbers in it. The estimates vary from a few thousand to a few billion. That tells you it isn't a description of Mother Nature or of the world around us. It's dartboard physics. As a scientist, I believe in dealing with the real world physics. And so, you know, life out there, sure, it's coming here. I don't know where, I have some ideas where some of it might come from, but we cannot make statements about the distribution of life out there because nobody's given us a map. Yeah, there are a bunch of civilizations over in this corner and a bunch over there. These guys have been fighting those guys. These guys have settled up over here. We don't know. Look, I'm a scientist, not a writer. Michael's a good writer. He's a good stand-up comedian. I watch some of his stuff on YouTube. But that's different from science. You have to say you don't know. I have a huge gray basket. I know that the evidence is that there are critters, if you will, coming here in manufactured craft. That doesn't mean I know why, who, how. I mean, I try to deal with these questions on my website and elsewhere. But we cannot make any statements about how common or how rare, because we haven't picked up a signal. Using our equipment, we presume that aliens are stuck at our level of technology. I find that an extraordinary claim. What basis do we have? And we know how quickly our technology has evolved. Look at the past 110 years or so. You know, flight and radio and microwaves and DNA and a whole slew of things in a lousy 100 years. So what if somebody got started a little bit before we did, you know, say 10,000 years?
Michael, your turn.
Well, the SETI program with the so-called Drake equation, you know, this is just the first approximation to get our minds around thinking about how best to try to make contact if there is some intelligence out there. So while it's true for some of the components of the equation, such as how many planets typically give life, you know, we have no idea. But some of the other parts of the equation are getting more refined. For example, the number of planets, the number of stars that have planets, number of G-type stars like ours that have planets and so forth. I mean, we've discovered now over about 250 extrasolar system planets. And so it's giving us a good approximation that at least 10% of every star in the galaxy has planets. And that's probably a conservative estimate. So we can thereby start to make slightly more refined probability guesses that, well, you know, probably the chances are even more that there's extraterrestrial life out there. That's, in, you know, sort of a plus for both SETI and, I suppose, the UFO community. And, you know, when they launch Kepler in a few years, and it'll be able to find planets around stars the size, or be able to find planets the size of Earth, not just Jupiter-sized. The only reason we find Jupiter-sized planets is because that's the level of sophistication of the technology. So, but what I just told you is not anything that any SETI scientist would tell you. I mean, that wouldn't tell you. I mean, Seth Shostak's been on your show.
Sure.
He would say everything I just said, and he would not make any claims about we know or we don't know. And I mean, what Seth and all the SETI scientists say is we have to look. We don't know. Nobody knows. And these are just first approximations. And I'm not sure why Stan is degrading or putting down the SETI program. I don't know what the purpose of that is. I mean, they're not making any particular claims. They're just looking.
Yes, they are making a particular claim. They're claiming that nobody's coming here, but if we want to find extraterrestrial intelligence, we got to look for a signal.
I don't think they make any claims about that unless you ask them. I mean, they've never published anything like, we hereby declare we don't think people have come here.
But, I mean, they've said that, though, Michael.
Ask them, I suppose they'd say, yeah, I doubt it, like something along
those, I would say.
But that's not part of the SETI program. The SETI program is just a scientific search. And whether they come here or not is not part of their paradigm. They're not looking for aliens here. That's not part of their
program. When there's evidence that there are aliens here, and we have no evidence, as you have said, and I've agreed, we really have no evidence about what's going on out there, all we can do is look at what's coming here. We don't
obviously
see
Stan, they
doesn't
don't
mean nobody's
agree
sending
with your
them.
Evidence.
I'll agree with that, too.
Obviously, they don't agree that there's evidence that they've come here. If they did,
you haven't looked at the evidence. That's one of the most remarkable aspects.
I completely disagree with you there, and I would recommend to your listeners a terrific book on this subject called Roswell by Carl Flock, who I believe you've had on the show, George.
Mm-hmm.
He is a UFO believer now. He believes aliens have come here, are coming here. And this is an
hardly a UFO.
He completely debunks all of the Roswell stuff and really shows, I think, with great intellectual courage and honesty, how easy it is to filter out evidence that supports what you want to believe. And he was once a Roswell believer. Now he's a Roswell skeptic, even though he remains a UFO believer. And
he doesn't remain a believer. He's deceased.
Well,
Carl is dead. He is not around
to
defend himself,
so I have to be careful what I say.
I've read his book. I've commented about his book. There are serious problems with the book. You know, you look at evidence, and that's what I try to do in my book.
That's what he does, and he dismantled your evidence piece by piece, I thought, pretty thoroughly.
Well, obviously,
he's in your camp, and he still debunks you. So you don't even have to turn to Skeptic Magazine. Turn to one of your fellow ufologists and read his book, Roswell, by Prometheus Books.
Of course, I read his book, and of course we know Prometheus publishes pretty much only debunking kind of material. You've made an extraordinary claim that he takes care of alien visitations or of Roswell. That is a truly extraordinary claim. And I've been trying to figure out why you make such claims, and I've come up with a solution.
Wait, I'm just addressing just Roswell and just one of your own fellow believers debunking of your work at Roswell. I'm not making any extraordinary claims. I think it's a terrific book, and listeners out there should read it.
That is an extraordinary claim.
But see, your claim is that no one takes your evidence seriously. Yes, they do. They've looked at it, and they've not accepted it.
Well, that's what you're saying. That's not what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's true, though.
Plenty
of scientists have looked at all the stuff that you've done and the other ufologists. They reject it.
All right, well, stay with us, both of you. My gosh, this is like a Rocky movie where the gloves have already come off, and we're just in the first round. Stay with us. The Skeptic's Cage, where two go in and one comes out. Both their websites, Stanton Friedman's and Dr. Michael Shermer, you can find linked up at coasttocoastam.com as well. And we'll continue this. And then in the top of the last hour, when we take phone calls, I'll open up the fast blasts and you can vote. Don't do it now. The debate is far from over. And welcome back to Coast with Dr. Michael Shermer, Stanton Friedman, both our guests here. And, of course, we'll take your phone calls later on tonight. Michael, let me ask you this, and Stanton, you will get right back into this. But, Michael, do you believe that we went to the moon?
Yeah, of course.
You do. And, of course, Stanton, you do.
And I wouldn't dare be skeptical of that because Buzz Aldrin might punch me in the face like he did that guy.
Well, yeah, that guy was harassing him. Swear on a Bible and all that. But why, Michael? Why do you believe we went to the moon? Because I do too, by the way. But there are some compelling arguments that would show we did not go.
I don't think they're compelling at all. First of all, we have the moon rocks. We have the spacecraft that are still up there, and you can still the spacecraft we sent up there that detect distances between the Earth and the Moon, for example, we still get signals back from them, so we know they're there. We have the testimony, of course, of all the astronauts who went. We have tens of thousands of people that worked in NASA that would all have to be part of the cover-up if there was such a thing. We have amateur astronomers who watched the spacecraft, the Apollo spacecraft, on its way out. A friend of mine watched them doing a dump on the way out, a urine dump and all that. So it's pretty obvious that we went to the moon.
How about you, Stan? Of course.
Well, of course, I believe we've gone to the moon. I've talked to a number of astronauts, not just Buzz, and I'm satisfied we've gone there. And, we're getting signals back from the we did get signals back from the seismometers that were left there, to record moonquakes. I better not say earthquakes, I guess. I've looked at the arguments against our having gone there, and I don't find any of them satisfactory, just as I don't find any of the arguments against flying saucer reality satisfactory. I think Michael can probably give us the website from the guy who says Bad Astronomy.
Oh, that's our buddy Philip Plate.
Yeah.
Bad Astronomer.
BadAstronomer.com, yeah.
Yeah, he goes through a lot of these arguments. And, you're never going to convince everybody of anything. And people ask me sometimes, what do you say to a skeptic? I say, I'm not gearing my approach to a skeptic. You got your bell-shaped curve and your extremists at both ends who say, don't bother me with the facts, my mind's made up. They're here to save us, or they can't possibly be coming here. Well, how do you deal with people who don't want facts? That's the difference. And so I try to deal with the healthy agnostics, if you will, and I've certainly gotten past any agnosticism. I worked in the space program. Any agnosticism about whether we've been to the moon or not, I'm absolutely convinced that we have been. It's kind of a waste of effort to deal with the people who say we haven't when it's already been dealt with. It's not a new argument.
Stanton, with the universe being about 14 billion years old, a little less, and we being 4.5 billion years old, there's this huge gap by billions of years. Do you believe, if there's extraterrestrial life out there, Stanton, do you believe that it can survive that gap? Planets let's say planets formed several billion years before ours, so they have a biological jump start probably on us. But can civilizations live that long?
We don't know, and we're surely pushing right now when you consider all the nuclear warheads sitting around. We're sort of asking for trouble if the wrong guys get hold of them. But that isn't really the question. As a matter of fact, one of the nice things about looking at lots of UFO evidence, which, of course, the skeptics, debunkers, don't, is that you see here that life moves on, that there's colonization, that there's migration. So how long it lasts doesn't really matter. In terms of timescales that we know something about, I don't worry what happened a billion or a million years ago on this planet. We don't know much about the past history of the planet. Ignorance is bliss, I suppose, for some people. I'm thinking of Heinrich Schliemann, who said, I think Troy ought to be right here, the mythical Troy from the Iliad and so forth. This is about 1875 or so. And a historian said, hey, come on, there's no Troy. This is bunk. That's mythology. Well, he was rich, and he could afford to pay people to dig down 75 feet, and lo and behold, he found Troy from just a few thousand years ago. Now, how much of the planet have we explored down 75 feet, George? It's a darn small percentage of it. So we may have had many civilizations that have come and gone, and that isn't the question. The question is what's happening now. That's where we say there are alien visitors.
All right, Michael, let's get your take on that question.
First of all, we should remember that for every Heinrich Schliemann who successfully discovered something that really exists, there's, you know, 1,000 non-Schliemanns who had wild ideas about Atlantis and lost continents here and lost cities there, and they never found them. And so we tend to remember the hits and forget the misses. We exalt the heroes, the Galileos, the Wright brothers. You know, they laughed at the Wright brothers. Yeah, well, they laughed at the Marx brothers. So what? Being laughed at doesn't make you right or wrong. It's a separate issue. And one of my columns for Scientific American, which I wrote on the value of L. L in the Drake equation is the length of time that a civilization might last, and it's notoriously, you know, empty in the Drake equation. I mean, what number do you plug in there? We only have one civilization. Well, a different way to look at it is how long have civilizations lasted on Earth? And the answer turns out to be roughly about 350 years before a political unit goes extinct and essentially you start over with a different political unit, something like that. Now, the SETI people have countered my argument there, my argument being that L is very low, not enough time. That's why we haven't heard from extraterrestrials yet. Not enough time for them to have gotten here. Their civilizations go extinct, something like that. And their counter to that is you don't have to have a single continuous political unit. You just have to have the technology carried forward from one political organization to another, one civilization to another. As long as you have the technology of space exploration, once it's achieved, it can't be eradicated, something like that. Well, you know, these are kind of fun thought experiments, but that's all we have at the moment on that is the history of life on Earth. So, but I think your question is hugely important and deep that and Stan referred to this earlier, that any civilization that we would encounter is not going to be, first, as I said, they're not going to look anything like us. But second, they're not going to be just barely ahead of us, technologically speaking. I mean, the idea that we back-engineered from alien spacecraft to transistors because we were still stuck at the vacuum tube stage. You know, transistors are just, you know, one more step above that. And now we're, you know, moving on beyond that and so forth. Like they're only 10 years ahead of us technologically. I mean, they would be millions of years ahead of us technologically because the chance of them evolving in lockstep pace with us is pretty nil. So
we probably agree, Michael.
Yeah. So that's why I thought Sagan's brilliance in Contact was to not show the aliens. You know, when Jodie Foster encounters the alien, it's her father.
Right, in an image of. That's
yeah,
right.
They pulled the image out of her mind, right? Well, he did that for a reason, because he recognized our chauvinism, that we always tend to show aliens to be a lot like us, but they have less hair or bigger heads or, you know, something like that. And he used to call this, you know, carbon chauvinism, that even the very idea of that we have to be based on carbon, you know, that itself may be a egocentric, chauvinistic position. And we it's really hard for any of us to get around that.
Okay,
I think we need to recognize, though, that normally you start with evidence to figure out how something's going to look and how many elephants, you know, do you have to look at. Anyway, you better find at least one. We've got loads of reports of aliens with the 4,000, 5,000 physical trace cases. 1/6 of them involve reports of strange beings with strange craft. So we should use the evidence to determine our best guess as what the guys who are coming here look like, not what the guys who are out there look like. The ammonia breathers may be altogether different, but it isn't chauvinism.
But the quality of your evidence for what you just said, your 4,000 trace evidences, whatever, is no different than that for Bigfoot and Loch Ness.
Hold on, Stan.
Let him finish, then you can jump in.
When I talk to the Bigfoot people, they say the same thing. Look, how can you deny the fact that we have thousands and thousands of eyewitness accounts, and they all describe something similar to, you know, the Bigfoot image that we all know? And same thing with Loch Ness. Go on, and I always say, yes, of course it's possible, and maybe those anecdotal stories will add up. Once we have a body, we'll know.
Anecdotal, Michael? Hey, I had soil tested from a physical trace case. That's not anecdotal. It's lab testing.
Yeah, but
cost me good hard-earned cash.
The larger point here is that
all
is
we
that
have
everybody
is anecdotal
makes
evidence.
Like that, and that's how you start a research program. Anecdotes are fine to start a research program, but at some point, if you want to name a new species in biology, you have to have a type specimen, an actual body. So once you have that, then
black hole, Michael. No, you don't.
Well, hold on, Stan. Hold on. This is turning out to be Larry King. You guys are punching each other out here. Hold on. You all have a shot here. Go ahead, Michael.
In biology, if you want to name a new species, you have to have a type specimen, a holotype. You have to have an actual, you know, something of evidence, some physical thing that can be photographed, dissected, put on the cover of National Geographic. You know, other scientists can come study it and so on. And you can't do that with these anecdotal stories and blurry photographs and grainy videos and all that. It's a place to start a research program, but ultimately we need some kind of actual spacecraft or alien body.
Sure.
Or
all right. So we've established the fact, though, that it's very possible that extraterrestrial life exists. Now what we got to do is spend the time here to debate the merits of whether that life has gotten here again. Stanton Friedman, propulsion system. If they came here, how did they come here?
Well, the first answer ought to be, obviously, we don't know since we're not going out there. But I've worked on advanced propulsion systems, a wide variety of them, some of those canceled government-sponsored programs I've worked on. Some of them were spending pretty good money, I must admit, and not that I was getting paid that much. there are several possibilities. The first you want to think about is nuclear, because, as we know, one nuclear fission gives you a couple hundred million times as much energy as a typical burning reaction, you know, combining two fuels, oil and air, for example. And I worked on fission rockets. We tested them quite successfully before the program was canceled, mm-hmm. I might add. I worked on fusion rockets. Now, I mentioned fusion is of particular interest to me because fission requires uranium. Uranium is a heavy element. The Earth has a good supply of uranium, but out there it may not be so much. But fusion is what goes on in all the stars. So as a starting place for any advancing civilization, they're going to try to figure out how their star produces the energy it obviously produces, mm-hmm. It's heating the planet and so forth. And so we just figured out that it was fusion in 1938. Before that, it was a mass of burning gas, and estimates as to the age of the solar system were dependent on that assumption, which means it wasn't very old because you'd burn it all up in a hurry. Okay, fusion is pretty spectacular. You use isotopes of hydrogen and helium, which just fortunately happen to be the most abundant and the lightest elements. That's kind of neat if you're going into space. And wherever you're going to go, you're going to find hydrogen and helium. So it's not like uranium. Fusion, when I was working on it, 47 years ago. That's a distressing thought. 46 years
ago. Well, could they be coming this way, though, Stan, through maybe a portal?
Well, the thing is, before we get to the far-out stuff, let's look at what we know. And one of the things I find disturbing is that the SETI community, for example, doesn't even talk about fusion. I mean, we could kick particles out the back end of a fusion rocket that had 10 billion times as much energy, or 10 million times as much energy per particle as they can get in a dumb old chemical rocket. That's a nice jump from where we're at, but it's something we know something about. And people say, well, what are we doing with fusion? We build H-bonds, of course. That's fusion, nuclear fusion. And as a matter of fact, there was the Orion project. You carry along a whole bunch of H-bombs. You throw one out the back, explode it. It pushes off the back end of your rocket. You move ahead a little. You throw another one. Kind of an interesting approach. I'm not sure I'd want to be the guy handling the bombs. But what I'm saying, you start with what you know. And an important part of this question is how far are they coming from? Now, I've heard debunkers start, well, let's take the nearest galaxy. I don't care about the nearest big galaxy. Andromeda's 2 million light years away. So what? Let's look at the local neighborhood. Within 55 light years, there's a couple of thousand stars, at least 50 are like the sun. That's a good enough concern for me. You know, I need a loaf of bread for dinner. I don't tell my wife, well, I'll be back next week. I'm going down to Australia. There's a great bakery there. The store is a mile and a half away. So let's look at the local neighborhood. And when we do that, we find that, you know, the sun isn't the best example of a place where you'd expect to have interstellar travel, as discussed in Captured, the Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 reticula.
All right, let me put a little time limit here on you, okay. Stanton. We'll go to you now, Michael Shermer. You say they're not coming here, therefore, I'm sure you don't think there's a propulsion system capable of coming here.
Well, no, I wouldn't say that. I think, actually, you know, NASA has a program of studying alternative propulsion systems as a way for us to use it to do space exploration ourselves. So I find a lot of that stuff really interesting. And, you know, a lot of it probably won't pan out, but that's what you have to do to develop a technology. You have to allow a lot of failure.
Yep.
So, I think that's perfectly fine. And the SETI people have thought about that. I mean, you know, that the possibility of looking for traces out there of propulsion systems or something like that. But, you know, they have limited budgets, limited time. They, you know, they have to look for what they think would be the likeliest form of communication or likeliest form of detection of existence, something like that.
All right. But, Mike, 1997, Phoenix, thousands of people, including Fife Symington, the former governor who was sitting there next to us on King's show, see something that they believe is a huge object. Question one to you, Michael. Did they see indeed an object? And the question is, where did it come from? Was it ours? What do you think?
Well, my best explanation for the Phoenix lights is the flares. I mean, we don't know 100% for sure, but, you know, when Fife says to me after the show, Larry King show, well, he actually said on the show, it was out of this world. What I saw was out of this world. Well, I asked him afterwards, how do you know? We have none of us have been to some other world, and we know, okay, that's what spacecraft looked like from that world, and what I saw didn't look like anything from this world, but it looked like something from that world. Well, no, of course. I think it's okay as a general principle of science and skepticism. It's just okay to say, I don't know, that we can't explain everything, and that 5 to 10% of anomalous UFOs or whatever that we have no explanation for, you don't have to have an explanation for everything in order to throw out. I mean, in other words, if there's 5%, say, of anomalous unexplained phenomena, you don't throw out the whole theory just because of that. All theories have a degree, what's called the residue problem. There's a residue of unexplained phenomenon in cosmology and physics, evolution, whatever. All major theories have unexplained phenomena. In fact, it's a good thing they do, because gives graduate students something to get their PhD with. So the unknown anomalies is where the action is. But the fact that we can't explain all of them doesn't mean that theory is wrong and some alternative theory that has next to no evidence.
All right, Stanton Friedman, when we come back at the top of the hour, we'll pick up with the Phoenix lights for you, Stanton.
Okay.
Then we'll talk about alien abductions, the MJ-12 documents, and get into, of course, the trained observer. Is he better than the untrained observer when it comes to UFO cases? And what about crop formations? Who's doing that and why? Stick with us. I'm George Norrie. The Skeptic's Cage continues on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, Stanton, Michael says that the Phoenix lights flares. Your take.
Well, one of the things that was a problem with Larry King's show is they kept showing the flares and ignored the stuff that happened earlier in the evening. I've talked to witnesses down there. We had something, the sky was clear, beautiful. It blotted out the stars behind it. It was huge. It was silent. It was seen from a lot of different areas. One thing about Fife, he was up kind of high, so he had a better look than some did, and he's a pilot. The flares are a completely separate kind of thing. Happened at like 10 o'clock. Dr. Bruce McAbee, one of many scientists who have dug into the UFO data, unlike Michael, did a careful study on those, and indeed they were flares, even though people were trying to mix the two together, the media mixed the two together. So, I don't think we have things more than half a mile wide that have flown. We have many reports of huge, I'll call them motherships because I don't know what else to call them. Space carriers sounds a little fancy. But let me illustrate something else here. Michael talked about 5% and a residue effect. And the kicker is, and that's a clear indication that he hasn't been looking at the evidence. In my lectures, I talk about five large-scale scientific studies. The biggest one is Blue Book Special Report 14, data on 3,201 sightings. 21.5% couldn't be explained, not 5%. And they were completely separate from the 9.5% for which there was insufficient information. 21.5% is not a residue effect. I wish 21.5% of drugs that people look at to cure diseases worked. They don't. In the University of Colorado study, 30%, according to a committee of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, 30% of the cases they looked at could not be identified. In the UFO evidence, and there are two volumes, early and late, more than 18% could not be identified. So these, of course, are not discussed in Michael's book, although I enjoyed reading Why People Believe Weird Things, because it gave me a diagnosis for Michael's problem. Why does he keep saying strange things? Why do smart people believe weird things?
You'll get your turn, Michael.
Diagnosis is like I have a disease.
Well, it sounds like it. Smart people believe weird things because they are skilled at defending beliefs they arrived at for non-smart reasons. To come to a conclusion about UFOs without looking at the large-scale scientific studies is not a smart reason. But Michael is smart, so he's good at defending a conclusion that is unjustifiable by data. The second thing is confirmation bias. Ignoring the evidence that doesn't fit with his preconceived notions. Oh, I'm sorry, Michael, but you seem to be suffering from this disease. A good cure would be to look at the evidence instead of claim that there isn't any.
All right, Michael, do you have a disease?
Well, I'm sorry to laugh. It's just sort of funny to diagnose somebody like that. I have a UFO sighting every January 1st at about 8:10 in the morning. Comes right over my house. It's huge. It's black. It blocks out the sky behind it. And, I don't know, it could be a mile across. Who knows? And of course, this is the B-2 bomber that leaves from, Edwards Air Force Base, flies down and swoops over the Rose Parade. And it circles around and does a couple laps, and it comes right over my house when it does that. And, you know, of course, we all know what the B-2 bomber is, so as soon as I see it, I go, oh, it's a B-2 bomber, cool, let's get the binoculars and so on. But let's say it was 20 years ago or 10 years ago, and they were just experimentally testing it, something like that, and I was out in the desert, and it was dark, and didn't know anything about this, and it's hard to judge size and distance without reference points when it's dark, and, you know, who knows what I might have thought otherwise. And so instead of saying, well, I don't look at the evidence or the eyewitnesses are liars or something like that, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that people can be genuinely, honestly mistaken, and we all do it.
We agree.
This is a human problem in perception, and I think that's where the action lies here in analyzing the data. Until we actually have a body or a spacecraft that we can all look at and so on, you know, the quality of the evidence, well, let's face it, the research on the validity of eyewitness testimony, everything from what we're talking about here to, you know, the witnessing of a crime or something, is not reliable. It just isn't. It's distressing.
Enough to do scientific experiments, maybe, but it's what we depend on in our everyday lives, in our courtroom lives. You don't need to be within plus or minus 2%. If you're describing a round vehicle that comes down, lands out in your field, takes straight up from your field, you know, maybe it's at an 80-degree angle instead of 90 degrees. Maybe it's 40 feet in diameter instead of 20. It doesn't matter. However, if you're describing a thief at a bank, you better get it a lot better than that. 20% isn't good enough.
Michael, have you ever seen any photographs of UFOs that you thought were compelling, that merited further investigation?
I've seen most of them, and most of them to me look fake and phony. There's a few that, you know, that I have no idea. And again, I'm perfectly comfortable just saying, well, beats me. I don't know. Maybe it's an experimental military aircraft. Who knows? I mean, the idea that, you know, governments lie for you know, national security reasons, of course they do. We know that. But that doesn't prove some particular claim you want to make just because governments lie. We know they lie. They lie like crazy. But one thing we also know, as witnessed recent events of anybody that's worked in the Bush administration, as soon as you're out of the loop, you are only too happy to go on Larry King promoting your new book, telling about what Bush said or what Cheney said, you know, the weapons of mass destruction. I mean, these are minor claims compared to, you know, aliens have come here in terms of their, you know, sort of big impact.
That would mean you'd expect much tighter security about the aliens, of course.
You would think so, and yet, you know, we would hear about it. If they, if
we have heard about it.
about it by now. It's the same thing like the 9/11 conspiracy theories.
Well, here's let me ask you this, Michael. Let me ask you this. Dr. Edgar Mitchell, whom I know, I have the utmost respect for, Apollo 14 astronaut, went to the moon, said on this program, and he's told me this several times now, that he believes that the people who have come to him, professional people, military people, governmental people, have told him that this planet has been, is being visited by extraterrestrials. Now, I don't think he would lie to me, so I believe that he's been told this,
yeah,
and he believes it.
Yeah.
I mean, so how do you answer that?
Well, I mean, I don't know how to answer it. I mean, it doesn't matter if it's Edgar Mitchell or
Buzz Aldrin.
Smith. I mean, Edgar Mitchell has the same brain and sensory apparatus.
Yeah, but an astronaut seems to have a different flair of credibility. You have to admit that.
I don't really think so. I think, you know, no more than anybody else trained in the sciences or who's gone to college or had critical thinking courses or whatever. I don't think so.
I don't think he's being deceptive.
And frankly, to be critical of science in a sense, scientists aren't special in any sense that they're above having their own confirmation bias and wanting to prove their own pet theories. And the difference is that science has built into it a self-correcting machinery that says if you don't look out for your own confirmation bias and attempts to prove your theories and select data, cherry-pick your data, somebody else will point that out, only too gleefully in a public forum, because science is pretty competitive.
As I just have, Michael, that you haven't looked at the relevant UFO data. There is
I have.
No
I've looked at it. I just don't
book.
Accept it. I just don't accept it, Stan. I'm sorry. I looked at it. I just
why isn't
compelling
Project
me.
Blue Book Special Report 14 mentioned? Why isn't the congressional testimony of 12 scientists, I'm the only one without a PhD in that crowd. Why isn't that even mentioned? Why isn't the work of Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who was the Air Force scientific consultant on UFOs for 20 years, put him in a good position to look at UFO data? Why isn't he mentioned? In other words, there's a very selective choice of data. And that isn't science.
Well, all they can tell you
confirmatory bias.
The way science works is that the burden is on
you. How do you know, Michael? You're not a scientist. You're a writer. You're an editor. You're a good. I've watched the.
I study science. The way science works is that there's a community. It's a social process. The burden of proof is on you to convince the community that you have something worthy of further study.
And, well, let me ask you this, Mike.
You haven't done that. Even the SETI people struggle against trying to get funding because not all scientists think it's a worthwhile project. And that's just how it works. In a free market society, you just have to go out there and hustle and try to convince the community that you have something worthwhile. And
so we're doing right now, Michael.
But Michael, you're saying you don't think we've been visited because we don't have the data, the evidence?
Yes, that's right. Most scientists do not. Most scientists think like I do on this question. Most, the vast majority, would not bother investing, say, National Science Foundation funds into further studying this because we have other problems that probably have a better probability of turning out to be right.
What evidence, Stan, could we give Michael Shermer or point
him? I'll tell you, a body or a spacecraft.
That'll do it for you.
Yeah, of course.
I'm glad it would do it for him. Obviously, it would do it for us all. But there are good, obvious reasons for not having that data turned over to us. The national security aspect, something which gets neglected in the SETI program discussions about extraterrestrial life, and certainly neglected by Michael in his books and in what he says on television, the national security applications of this are overwhelming. A means for delivering weapons that can outfight, outfly, if you will, everything we've got. Something that tells us that we're not the big shots we think we are as Earthlings. These are extraordinarily important things. And to suggest that they're not and they have no role, I mean, if we found this, we would immediately announce it. I mean, the first nuclear fission chain reaction at the University of Chicago, my alma mater, back in 1942, and no, I wasn't there then, that was an extraordinary event, and it wasn't one word in public. The development of the proximity fuse, extraordinary that you could do something like that.
And yet we all know about it now, so it does come out.
Well, how about this? Would you say it's possible, Michael, that our government could have information. Now, we talk about the evidence. The body, you want the body or the spacecraft? Is it possible that if they have it, they're not going to tell us about it?
I think it's highly improbable.
I mean,
possible, maybe tiny, tiny percentage. But look what happens whenever, I mean, we knew about Sputnik, for example. Look what happened with the little Mars rock.
Well, wait a minute. We knew about Sputnik because we needed money to get into the space race.
Yeah, and that's right. So, if we had alien spacecraft or something, I have no doubt that NASA would go straight to Congress and say, hey, we need another $1 billion.
NASA? NASA is not the Department of Defense. What are you talking about, Michael?
Look what happened with the discovery of the Mars rock that allegedly had alien life in it. This was a huge story. People went crazy, and NASA and JPL and so on went, hey, this is great. We should get more funding for our research and so on. That's what happens to these stories. Everybody hears about it. There aren't cover-ups.
There's no implications for everybody's life. If you say somebody's landing in the next mile over town and abducting our daughters and sons, that has enormous implication. Martian microbes of interest to people. No question about that. NASA was shocked by how many hits they got on
right.
the website.
But I think we expect that Mars might have had life like that, don't we? So it's really, as exciting as it is, it's not the intelligent extraterrestrial we're looking for.
If we found, let's say the face on Mars turned out to be an actual, you know, architectural monument or something, obviously
right.
built.
Richard Hoagland would be jumping for joy.
I have no doubt we'd all hear about it. It'd be the front page story. It'd be a huge, huge story. There'd be no attempt to cover
that. It would be very old, though, Michael. It wouldn't be a threat or have any involvement with our current here and now life, how we look toward each other, how we feel about each other. The recovery of a crashed alien vehicle has enormous implications, not only for national security. How does the darn thing work, which is an obvious one. But what does it say about us? Are they working with somebody else on this planet? Do we need to worry about an invasion? How can we duplicate it? What if the other guy across the ocean, everybody's got another guy, duplicates it before we do? The religious people are very concerned, some of them, not all of them. If this means that aliens are coming here, we have Pat Robertson saying there's no other intelligent life besides here on Earth. This stuff is the work of the devil. He's got a problem with intelligent aliens visiting because there's no other intelligence besides here. That's his mindset. But
this reminds me a little bit, if I can use a political analogy, of with the business of weapons of mass destruction and does Sodom have them or not. And as it became clear that they couldn't find any evidence of them, this was the sort of argument that the Bush administration made. Well, the fact that we can't find them means that they're there and they're hiding them.
Or they moved them somewhere.
Or they moved them, yeah. So, in other words, a lack of evidence was additional data. Well, no, wait, that's not right.
That's not what I'm saying about flying saucers.
It's like flying. Where are the flying saucers? Well, they exist, but they're hiding them, and that's how we know they exist because they're hiding them.
Talk to the people who've handled the wreckage, as I have, although most of them are dying now. But you sat next to.
You see, I think, Michael, you have to weigh in perspective some of the people who claim that they've seen things or touched things. Walter Hout, for example, that we tried to talk about right at the end of King's show, he's the dead late lieutenant who put out the original news release, who signs an affidavit at the before his death that claims he saw the craft and he saw the extraterrestrial bodies, albeit they were covered up, but he said
yeah.
they had big heads. Isn't that enough evidence to say, okay, I think I believe this guy?
Well, it's enough. It's an interesting story that piques our interest and say, let's go explore some more. I don't think you'd want to make a commitment to a belief system based on just
that. Wouldn't that get you?
If we could talk about the, you know, the realities of human nature, like Philip Corso, Stan, do you accept his stories?
I have a nice piece on my website about him, and no, I don't.
Yeah, okay, so people either are honestly mistaken, and sometimes, let's be frank, people make stuff up.
Yeah, I'll grant you that, Michael, including
so,
those people.
How are we to distinguish between the guy you believe and the guy you don't believe when they could all be making it up or honestly mistaken or
whatever? I check evidence, Michael. I checked on Corso. For example, that one little detail. He claimed he was a member of the National Security Council. I checked with the Eisenhower Library. He was never a member of the National Security Council. He never attended a meeting of the National Security Council. You know, a little factoid, call it what you want. I checked. There were many other things that I checked on. And when I look at the believable evidence, again, I find, if you check and you find it out, in my book, Top Secret Magic, I talk about a whole bunch of documents which I say are phony. There are people who believe those, but I give you the reasons, the data, the facts that show that they're phony, and there are a few that aren't phony, and I give you the reasons for my saying that. Let's deal with evidence. The evidence.
Okay, yeah, let's do that, Stan. I got an interesting letter after the Larry King show from a guy named Rob Godwin. I think you know him. He published the Apollo NASA mission reports. And after he heard the story about Buzz Aldrin and his UFO, he went and got the actual NASA mission reports that explained everything that was said and what it turned out to be and so forth. And he published this in a book that was widely distributed. It sold 20,000 copies. And after about 2 years or 18 months, he writes to me, I received a phone call at my office from Stanton Friedman. By then, my book was old news, but Dr. Friedman began with the conversation, asked me if it was true. I'd published the book. He wanted to know, how did I get that report? We've been trying to get it for years. And I replied, I asked them for it, and they gave it to me.
It took him a long time, too, and that's not how I recall.
And so his point is that if Stan Friedman is such a great researcher, how did he not even know about this guy's book? How did you not know about this guy's book? It was in Barnes & Noble and Borders. And how come you didn't call NASA and say, can I get a copy?
We don't have a Barnes & Noble or a Borders here in my town, as a matter of fact, but it's irrelevant. I knew that.
But if you're such a great researcher.
Well, hold on. Let him answer your question, Michael. Let him answer your question.
Now, a great researcher can't read everything ever done. I never considered Buzz's so-called sighting, his IFO sighting on the way to the moon, as evidence. I knew that he had even sued Charles Berlitz and William Moore because there was talk in the first Roswell book, the Roswell incident, about his supposed sightings on the moon. He had won his suit. I don't consider what he had to say evidence for flying saucers. You've never heard me say, hey, you know why these things are real? Because Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong and Collins saw one on the way to the moon. You've never heard me say
that. Gosh, I hate to break you here, Stanton, but we have to, but we'll be right back. The Skeptic's Cage continues. Stanton, let's talk a little bit about the training of observers versus untrained observers. Why is this important?
Well, because if you're looking for data and there's a limited amount of time for people to decide what they're observing, it's important that they have some training. Let me think of a fighter pilot during World War II or any other war. There have been plenty of them. Or cops under fire, friend or foe. Should you shoot or shouldn't? Or is that the mother and not the criminal? You know, there are all these kinds of questions. Training can help us make decisions quickly. And it's important to the life of a pilot, not just a combat pilot. Something unusual happens. You're trained to make a judgment based on a limited time, limited amount of evidence, but you've got to make a judgment. Now, Michael, the other night on Larry King, said there's no difference between a trained observer and an untrained observer. Well, if a trained observer, an ornithologist, tells me that a bald eagle just flew over, Michael would say, well, I don't believe that unless he shoots them and brings them in for lab analysis. It's worthless information. Or if a pilot tells me he saw two 747s go over his house within the past half hour. Well, if it's a layman from next door who says, I saw some kind of thing flying up there, whose testimony should we pay more attention to? I think trained observers are very important. I think that the investigation of any kind of phenomena, you know, we like to think science, oh, that means a lab experiment. Well, there's a lot of science that doesn't involve lab experiments where you can't control the variables. You depend on observations. The reason we can identify most UFO sightings, most, not all, not anywhere near all, is that people are good observers and poor interpreters. I've had many examples of that when I was living in Southern California, as a matter of fact. Three different times people described something flying by high. It was in sunlight. It was moving rapidly. Boy, it was strange. I had to push them not to interpret but to observe. They would say it was over the next hill. Well, you can't tell that. What direction was it moving? What time was it? What angle was it above the horizon? In all three cases, they gave me enough information so that I called Vandenberg Air Force Base because it sounded like a rocket fired down the coast, which does happen from time to time. I had seen one, and it can be quite spectacular if the sun has gone down but the rocket is still in the sun. In all cases, that's what it was, and I knew that they were telling the truth, that they were good observers, even though they didn't know what they saw. In one case, the people sitting out over on the beach on Manhattan Beach looking out, they said it was like a string of popcorn, these things. Something's moving along, and behind it, you get some bright flashes. Well, it turns out these were solid boosters. This was a special weather satellite, needed a lot more boost, and they were dropping them off a pair at a time. It was a good description. They didn't know what they were watching. So people, a trained observer, I mean, a trained astronomer will tell you, yeah, that's Venus. I know it's Venus because I know all about Venus. An untrained observer would say, well, there was a darn bright light in the sky. Well, what direction were you looking? What angle above the horizon? Get all the observables as opposed to the interpretables. And you find out, yeah, his description was right on. He didn't know what he was looking at. That's all right. So there is a big difference between testimony from somebody who's trained to mm-hmm. observe certain kinds of phenomena, like Fife Symington had been a pilot. It's important that he know what's flying in the sky when he's still flying a plane, incidentally. And so I value his observation more than the people who said, well, there was this little thing flying over there, and I saw these bright lights at 10 o'clock, and they moved in formation. Those were the flares. If we look at the data, they were the flares. We look at what Fife saw and what other witnesses, and there were lots of them in Arizona, saw.
Wait, Stan, you agree that the flares were just a terrestrial phenomenon, not extra.
Yeah, well, yeah, they were lit up above the ground, but yes, they were at 10 o'clock.
So you think that it was just a coincidence that aliens flew over Phoenix at the same time that the Air Force, whoever was launching flares?
It wasn't the same time. It was an hour and a half later.
Oh, okay,
I don't know why they were dropping their flares at that time. I do know that a lot of people were out looking because of Hale Bopp and because of the big noise.
Wait, Stan, I'm just
radio.
Trying to clarify what you believe. You believe that on the same night, just by chance, aliens happened to fly over the same area where the U.S. Air Force was also dropping flares an hour later?
An hour and a half later.
An hour and a half later. But
that's what happened. Now, I'm not
aliens
saying.
And U.S. Air Force, same night.
Well, Michael, it's possible that the military set off the flares after the reports of the UFO.
Yeah. That's certainly possible. I won't say it happened because I haven't talked to anybody who said, hey, look what we did, guys. Boy, did we fool the public. That's not what I'm saying. But coincidence is one of those words that's very much overused, Michael. And in this case, we have to look at two separate events. Lots of witnesses to both of them, granted. But you look at the careful investigation that's done by people like Dr. Bruce McAbee, an optical physicist who's good at looking at pictures, and incidentally, he's published in scientific journals about pictures that cut the mustard, if you will, about not from here kind of thing. Yeah, I don't call it coincidence. They may be related. They may not be. We don't know. All we know is what people saw the first time around, the early sightings by Fife and a myriad of other people, were not flares.
And it's possible whatever they did see could have been a military craft of some sort. We keep hearing those reports.
Yeah, and okay, so let's go back to the validity of eyewitness testimony and trained versus untrained. It's true that...
And let's use also, though, Michael, use Gordon Cooper as an example. A pilot, a late astronaut, claims that he saw a series of UFOs.
I have one other thing to read about that, too.
Right.
You mentioned Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell. My correspondent here I was reading from earlier, Robert Godwin, who did those books on the NASA mission reports, he writes, I should also point out that I have interviewed Apollo 14 astronaut Edgar Mitchell for my book, Apollo 14, the NASA mission reports. Ed Mitchell is one of the most charming, open-minded, and intelligent individuals I've had the pleasure to meet.
Mm-hmm.
I've never met anyone whose willingness to believe in things possible has been so frequently and regularly misquoted If you were to believe half the things attributed to Ed Mitchell, you would think he has an alien spaceship parked in his front lawn.
No, he never said that. Does he never?
But you do.
I had dinner with Edgar, and I find him a very bright, very engaging, very believable person. So anything I feel about him is based on our contacts in the same place at the same time.
When asked specifically on this program if he saw UFOs on the moon, he said, no, I did not. When asked specifically if he said that he see UFOs follow him on Apollo 14, he said, no, I did not. However, he did say, I believe we have been visited and are being visited because the people I have talked to who are in the know have told me, and I believe them.
So back to the question on trained versus untrained. It's true. Let's say in World War II, pilots were trained to, you know, what the different profiles, Japanese airplanes in profile look like, so you can spot them. A little practice, you get better at it. But that's assuming we know that the Japanese have airplanes and we know what they look like. And so here's a picture of one. This is what you're supposed to look like. What training can you give somebody to look for an otherworldly spacecraft?
If you have a crew of a reconnaissance aircraft, a multi-member crew, they spot it out the window. They pick it up on their radar. They talk to the ground. The ground picks it up and them on their radar, and it zips around in an incredible fashion, sticks with them, even puts out a signal that they pick up and are puzzled by. That's a trained crew.
But
their
whole
job as reconnaissance people.
Why does it have to be extraterrestrial? Why can't it just be terrestrial and you don't know about it? They don't know about it.
Well, if the enemy, everybody has an enemy, so call it the Soviet Union, call it whatever you want. If they have this kind of capability, our whole military situation would be in very different terms than it is now. If we had this capability, we'd use it. That's what they're developed for. And this is a long time ago. This is back in the 60s. That's particularly important because we had sea capability that we didn't have then. Our first supersonic flight, after all, was after Roswell. And yet Kenneth Arnold's observation a few months before the first supersonic flight, June versus October, was of something that was going someplace between 12 and 1,500 miles an hour, and the speed record was 685. If we had that, why haven't we used it in all the wars that we've had since then? So I'm not saying we're not trying to duplicate. I'm certainly not saying there aren't any secret systems about which neither you nor I know. I suspect that there are. I would expect that there are. The black budget is huge. People estimate from $30 to $50 billion a year. That's a lot of money. You mentioned the National Science Foundation before. The three nuclear weapons labs, Livermore, Los Alamos, and Sandia, have a total annual budget greater than the entire budget of the National Science Foundation.
And that's the budget we know of.
Well, yeah, what I'm saying is, you know, we're not talking piddling amounts here for military-related stuff. We're talking huge amounts.
All right, let me ask you.
They have stuff you just don't know about.
Let me ask you both about this. Alien abduction. Stanton, your take.
I'm convinced that some Earthlings have been abducted by some aliens. I am not saying that any time somebody says he's been abducted, we have to believe him. Each case has to be taken on its own merits. There's some fine work out there. I noticed that Michael refers to some of the books, a rather selective choice in his book. I hate to bring up Captured because we're going to do another show on that, I guess, George.
Yes, we are. I promised you that.
There's an excellent book, The Interrupted Journey, about the Hill case. Our new book updates that with a lot more data. Obviously, you couldn't fit in everything that was obtained back then. John Fuller did a fine job. But there was a lot more information that never made it into print. So I'm convinced some people have been abducted. And it's interesting that there was physical stuff on the car, the Hill's car, Betty's dress. This data is in the book, the analysis, the scientific analysis that's been done. Now, I'm perfectly willing to say that there are people who have lied through their teeth about being abducted. I don't know what they gain except perhaps attention, and I think Michael and I would probably agree that some people make extraordinary claims for no good reason at all.
Or they think they were abducted. That's another possibility.
Well, look, there's probably a gray basket there, too. But, again, when you have multiple witnesses, and I love how people bring up a sleep phenomena. Michael likes Susan Clancy's book, why people come to believe they've been abducted. I wrote a very strong review of that on my website, which points out error after error after error after error. It was kind of sickening to see all the false, wrong, specific wrong information, despite claims that she'd read everything and seen everything. The sleep phenomena doesn't explain people driving in a car who get abducted. It doesn't explain walking on a beach and being abducted. That some people suffer from sleep paralysis, of course. So what? That's irrelevant to the question. In other words, you have to look at the data relevant to the problem at hand, not the worst cases, the best cases. And sure, some people are allergic to penicillin. That doesn't mean you should never use penicillin. It means you got to be careful.
All right, Michael, your take on alien abductions.
Oh, I think they're all terrestrial. That is, I think they're psychological, social. If you look at the narratives of people that had experiences similar to this in the Middle Ages, they described them as incubi and succubi. This is the nightmares, the mare that haunts people in the middle of the night, coming through, sexually molesting them, and so on. 100 years ago, they described these very similar experiences as ghosts coming into the room or poltergeists. And today, our anomalous psychological experiences are described as aliens, because we don't live in a demon-haunted world or a ghost-haunted world. We live in a world of Star Trek and Star Wars and SETI and UFOs and Roswell and all that, and so our culture essentially tells our brains how to interpret the unusual phenomenon that we experience, whether it's through hypnosis or through sleep deprivation or through any number of different ways. There isn't one causal vector for the alien abduction experience. There's many different ways people can have strange, anomalous psychological experiences. So when it comes down to the question of what's more likely, that we know most of them for sure. I don't think people make this stuff up, by the way. I don't think they're lying. I don't think they're making things up to sell books or anything like that. I think I've met a lot of the abductees. I think they have genuinely had an experience. The experience they've had is very real. The question is, what does it represent? So we know for sure lots of them represent sleep paralysis or hypnotic regression or whatever. What are the chances, what's more likely, that the rest are also under that umbrella of the causal net, and we just don't understand them yet or haven't looked into them carefully or don't have enough information, or that most of them are under that causal explanation, and aliens are also coming here and doing the exact same thing simultaneously and coincidentally?
I think the
more prudent explanation is that they're psychological and we just can't explain every single one of them.
That's broad brush treatment without looking at individual cases, which is what you have to do. Now, you mentioned hypnosis. Dr. Benjamin Simon, who worked with the Hills, demonstrated that medical hypnosis is a very good tool for helping people who've had traumatic events take place. Today we call it post-traumatic stress syndrome. I've seen the movie that he did for the Army, in which he treated shell-shock war veterans. They didn't have the PTSD back then as a term. And it's a great way to get at what really happened, and the proof of it is the people get better. And so he was not biased pro-abduction. As a matter of fact, and that's one of the important points in the book Captured, is that it's clear he was trying to keep them away from an alien explanation. Well, Barney picked up Betty's dreams, and you talk about hypnotist bias. It's clear there that his bias was in the other direction. Now, none of the debunkers talk about that. I'm not saying there hasn't ever been bias on the part of a hypnotist. Of course there is. But there's a difference between parlor hypnotism and the kind of stuff that was used by Dr. Simon, a serious professional person, and yes, I did speak with him, and I did meet Betty and Barney, and one of the differences here between Michael and I've been to 20 archives, he makes general statements. I've talked to other abductees and to other abduction investigators who have spent an enormous amount of time and effort. Michael doesn't do that. He doesn't look at the relevant evidence. He's got the broad brush. Obviously, we have a simple explanation for this. Most of these are psychological problems. Look, that's like saying claims that there are tall people on the planet are foolish. I can prove to you 99% of the people around are less than 7 feet tall, therefore there is nobody who's tall, taller than that.
Wait, that's a categorical error. That's mixing up two. We're talking about completely different things with aliens and humans versus tall or short humans.
We're talking about dismissing data because it doesn't match your preconceived notions about what it should be. Your sparkling review of Susan's book is a good indication of that. You didn't mention any of the myriad of factual misstatements. You didn't want to see them. You didn't know enough about abductions and other literature about them to deal with it. Now, you know, at some point you got to crawl in with the data and see what's really going on instead of being satisfied with what debunkers say. There's a 10-page bibliography in Top Secret Magic. I include a whole bunch of debunking books. I also mention 10 PhD theses about UFOs. You mentioned one, David Jacobs. There are others. In other words, an incomplete examination of the data can lead one to go astray with one's conclusions. How's that? That's a polite way of saying that, I think.
I guess my response to that would be, Stan, once I've examined, say, a dozen or two dozen alien abduction cases, I've met the people, talked to them, read their narratives and accounts and so on, and I can really see what's really going on with it. They were regressed in hypnosis, which is not reliable. They had most of them woke up in the middle of the night, type of sleep experience. I don't need to read 250 more to see if maybe there's one nugget in there. It's pretty obvious what's going on. And
well, that's a big generalization, from a dozen to 250 more.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. It's
it's an extraordinary conclusion.
And all of it is based.
Okay, well, both of you hang on, because we're coming up to the top of the hour. And those of you who have the ability to fast blast, because you have a computer, if you have a computer, you can fast blast. Just go up there and sign in. Here's the vote, and here's how you have to do it. Let's keep it simple. Either pick Stan or Stanton or Michael. Simple as that. Stan or Stanton or Michael. We'll tabulate them. I'll give you the results at the end of the coming hour, but we've got your phone calls next with our special guests as well, and I'll hold them each to about 2 minutes per response so we can get in as most of your calls as possible. I'm George Inori, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Dr. Michael Shermer, Stanton Friedman. Michael, what do you do next after a debate like this? What's new with Skeptic Magazine?
Oh, I'm going to bed after this. I'm on the West Coast here. Our next issue of Skeptic actually is on medical controversies. For example, vaccinations and autism, the origins of AIDS. Things like that. We kind of bounce around to different subjects. We've done the science and religion thing to death. We've done the evolution creationism thing to death. We've done a lot on UFOs and aliens. And so I'm always looking for new controversies. I'm also working on one on global warming and, environmental change and stuff like that. You know, there's so much politics in the science, it's hard to separate them. And that's ripe ground for Skeptic Magazine.
How about you, Stan? What's next for you? Any conferences coming up?
Well, yeah, I'm going to be speaking at the Mutual UFO Network Symposium, 38th annual, 10th, 11th, 12th of August in Denver. My paper will be 60 years after Roswell. My co-author, Kathleen Martin, will talk about new data on the Betty and Barney Hill case. I'm told registration is up over last year already, so I'm really looking forward to it. I'm also, just today, got word about a new book, Flying Saucers and Science, that the publisher is going to back. And that's always a good day when you get that. Of course, now I got to produce the rest of the book. So that's going to keep me busy. And I'm going to be in West Virginia for something unique, 7th and 8th of September. In Charleston, West Virginia, there'll be a big event about the events of the summer of 1952, the Flatwood Monster case.
Oh, yeah.
The case where the pilots were other cases where the pilots were instructed to shoot them down if they don't land when instructed to do so, which there ought to be pages of cartoons that come out of that line from the government.
It's a good story. To the phones we go, and I'm going to keep you to each of about a couple minutes apiece. On your responses. Wildcard line, you're on the air. Hi there.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Yes, sir. Take it away.
Michael, I want to go back to something Stanton touched on in regards to trained observers. How does one explain multiple radar stations tracking the same UFO, the same location, performing the same maneuvers, all of which are far beyond anything the U.S. or Russia could produce? These are solid objects being clocked at thousands of miles an hour. The radar stations, in often many cases, would be examined afterwards, and there would be no equipment there. And these are also trained military radar observers, not just in the U.S., but, you know, in many countries. Books by Richard Dolan, Tim Good, they're rife with sightings like these over the last 60 years. I can see what you're saying about eyewitness accounts. It's hard to prove them. But when you're talking about radar stations, sophisticated equipment, I don't understand how those can be debunked. And I'll take your answer off the air.
Yeah, well, you sort of lost me on the part about they went to check it and there was no equipment there. I'm not sure where that was. But assuming that, let's say, independent radar stations track something, yeah, of course, obviously there's something there. What that something is, you know, who knows? Maybe it's an alien spacecraft. Maybe it's a top-secret military aircraft we don't know about. Maybe there's some misreading of the data on the radar of how fast it was actually traveling. Maybe it was traveling pretty fast but not that fast. And, you know, who knows?
Okay, do you want to comment at all on that, Stan?
Well, just that there are a lot of good radar cases that the government itself admits it can't identify. And if we had that kind of capability as observed by the radar, we would be using it. The Japan Airline case up in Alaska, the FAA was involved in monitoring this 747 being circled around by a rather large object as seen from the ground and by the crew and so forth. The papers were taken to a meeting in Washington by Mr. Callahan of the FAA. Everybody was told to shut up, and all the records were kept. It's very hard to throw that out as anything conventional. Not much going on up in Alaska, incidentally, where this happened. So a lot of good cases. Radar visual are particularly significant, written up by Jim McDonald way back in his congressional testimony of 1968. It's too bad Michael can't refer to that volume.
Next up, Wildcard Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes.
Have either of you gentlemen seen the January 2007 edition of Behavioral Science, Volume 35, Issue 3? The title of the article is Psychology and the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence.
Oh, no, I didn't see that.
It's a very interesting article. I strongly recommend both of you check it out. Basically, psychology is proposing an exopsychological research, which would encompass search, contact, post-contact activities, to include study and working with humans as well as with any extraterrestrials that might be encountered. I mean, this is a bona fide scientific journal.
Yeah, I think that's great. I think we should.
Who wrote the article?
It's written by Albert Harrison and Alan Elms.
Yeah, I don't know them. But no, SETI has whole papers and books on this. What to do if we make contact? What would they be like? How do we communicate? All that's important to do. I think that's a good thing.
Yeah,
that was the January issue of...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
What was the name of the journal again?
Oh, it's Behavioral Science.
Oh, okay.
Volume 35, Issue 3.
Okay, very good. Okay.
January.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's move on to West of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is John from the state of Washington, under the shadow of the great mountain Rainier.
Yes, you are. Thanks, John.
Yes, I am. And before 9/11, I had two lights come over, very bright, over my house. And they were a finger length apart. Okay? Two. 9/11. Two. Now, I've had these lights come over and stop and blink at me. I mean, the whole bottom of the craft lit up. Now, I couldn't see the outline, but I could see the outline of the light. Now, my question is to Mike. Michael, why do you push your agenda so much? Are you in it for the money? Because you're not believable.
Yeah,
the angels of God. Look, even if it were just the angels of God, okay? The Bible talks about the chariots of heaven. And the fire that would come down with Ezekiel. Why do you push your agenda so much? You're a plant, or you're in it for the money. That's all I got to say. Goodbye.
Okay.
Hey, Michael, I hope you got paid a lot for that Larry King show. All I got was a mug.
Loaded, right. I'm a plant. Agent of disinformation. Yeah, anyway. Well, okay. Next.
For no further comment, huh?
No further comment.
All right. Let's go east of the Rockies. You're on the air with us. Hello there.
Hi, how are you? George.
Yes, sir.
Good. I love your show, George. It's doing great things. My name's Dimitri from the Chicagoland area.
Hello, Dimitri.
Now, Dr. Stanton, Freedom? Freedom?
I'm not a doctor. He's the doctor.
Oh. Now, you're the physicist. I respect you greatly. I'm actually an aerospace engineer, and I sent you pictures last week from Wednesday night where there were four plasma orbs behind my house here in Chicago, Illinois, where all the activity is happening. And I gave a report to MUFON, and I'm working with the UFO investigator, and we're taking care of this. I had some great pictures that I'd like you to take a look at. Some definitely trigonal bipyramidal structure in the craft, okay? And to Michael, the debunker, you're not a skeptic. You're a professional debunker, and you seem like a very smart man, but you have to open up your mind. They're here, you know, and what are we going to do about it? You have to tell the American people. They're here. We have to do something about it. And they're, you know, and it's actually the greatest discovery of all mankind. This is great. So either they're here to help us or hurt us, but either way, it's a great discovery. And thank you very much. Like I said, I respect both of you very much. And, George, you're doing great things.
All right, let's let you comment on this, Michael, if you would like.
Well, yeah, I'm not a debunker. I'm just a skeptic, a scientist, whatever. I mean, I'm completely open to the idea. As I said at the start of the show, I would be amazed if we were alone in the cosmos. I mean, that would be far more shocking than that there were extraterrestrials out there. But, you know, have they come here? I just don't think so. I'm open to the idea that they have. But, again, show me the body. Show me the spacecraft. Grab one of those widgets off the dashboard or one of those probes that they used. Something like that would really convince us. And if science was really that dogmatic and closed-minded, we wouldn't have all these terrific, amazing revolutions. I know you've had Michio Kaku on the show before.
We sure have.
And he's way out there on the cutting edge, but within the sort of respectable boundaries. And, you know, I completely agree with him on most of his stuff. And, you know, there is room for open-mindedness in science, but you have to be cautious because there's so many wrong ideas. You can't just go accepting everything and be so open-minded that your brains fall out.
How about you, Stan?
Well, I certainly agree with that last thing, but before reaching a conclusion, you have to study the evidence. That's what we're really dealing with here, the failure to deal with the evidence. And I don't care whether it's Michael or my University of Chicago classmate Carl Sagan, who had the gall to say that there are interesting sightings that aren't reliable sightings that aren't interesting. Both of those are true, but no interesting and reliable sightings when the biggest study ever done shows exactly the opposite. But, of course, he gives no reference. So dogmatic statements, yes, you have to watch out for them.
Okay, next up, first-time caller line, your turn. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hello there.
Hello, this is Paul from Vallejo, California.
Hey,
listening
Paul.
To you on KSFO.
Good to have you with us.
Yes, hello, Michael. Thank you very much. George Norrie, I've been listening to you since you've been on, and Arbel a long time. I have a question for Michael.
Okay.
I was in the military. I was in the submarine service and later was transferred to a security group at Skaggs Island. We had a couple of outrageous experiences. We had, in the early 80s, we had an object about 400 feet long set down on the main intelligence site. The Joint Chiefs of Staff, members of it, came down, debriefed all people involved. My question for Michael is, I have been there, I've done that, seen that. How in the world can he justify the military's reactions to these type situations? My gosh, the information is there for anybody to know. All you have to do is just listen. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Yeah, these are... you know, individual stories like that are, you know, really difficult to explain. I wasn't there. I don't know, you know. I mean, what were the conditions? What did he see? It's like a ghost story, you know. I woke up at 3 in the morning and I saw this orb or whatever. I don't know, you know. It's impossible to say without studying it and, you know, trying to get corroborative reports or something like that.
You know, I was going to ask you if you believed in ghosts, Michael.
Oh, No, I don't, because, well, for two reasons.
Well, that's another show we're going to have to bring you back for, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, okay.
Okay, let's go to our West of the Rockies line. You're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Yeah, hi, George. It's Eddie San Diego.
Hey.
Your Gemini brother. This question is kind of for Michael and George. I mean, for
Stan.
Before the big hoopla of UFOs in the world, World War II, the Foo Fighters, seen by Japanese, seen by American pilots, has there been much investigation into them? And how do they explain that when UFOs are seen by nuclear places? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, you first, Stan.
Well, there's no question. I was just reading a paper by a PhD from New Hampshire who noted he did a very detailed study of sightings in counties where there were nuclear facilities and in counties where there weren't, and a cross-comparison sightings per 1,000 population, a lot of data compiled. And there's no question there was a higher number of sightings in places where there were nuclear facilities. What this means, I'm not sure of. One thing is nice, though. You can measure radiation from the air. And so it might be an easier way to check on things. I certainly have felt that our opening up the nuclear bottle, so to speak, would be of concern on two levels to aliens. The second one being that means that soon we'll be able to go out there with our brand of friendship, which everybody else calls hostility, and that would be worrisome to anybody in the local neighborhood. I mean, we're obviously a primitive society whose major activity is tribal warfare. We're using our threatening with nuclear weapons, and no question they'd be interested. So I think that you need to look at the bigger picture here of the overwhelming evidence from a dozen different directions, not just one direction. So, you know, let's get with it. Let's look at data. More PhD theses, not fewer, are required.
Michael Shermer?
Right. Well, sure, of course. I mean, more research is always good, but we have limited time and limited resources. And I guess for my money, I feel like the UFO thing has been, beaten to death now. And until there's actually some concrete evidence, you know, actual, and as I keep saying, a body or a spacecraft or something we can sink our teeth into, or and even when politicians, big ones, you know, Governor Richardson from New Mexico, even Clinton himself, have tried to, you know, uncover the so-called cover-up, they can't find anything. Well, if they can't find anything, you know, how are we really going to pursue this and uncover the conspiracy or whatever? More likely is that there's nothing that's being covered up, and we should invest our research dollars and time in other areas.
Michael, what got you into the area of being skeptical about so many things?
Oh, well, I was always interested in the paranormal and psychic power, that kind of thing. I remember when I was in graduate school in experimental psych in the mid-70s, Uri Geller was all the rage, and Thelma Moss had a lab at UCLA in which, you know, they were testing out-of-body experiences and psychic power, telekinesis, that sort of thing. So I figured there must be something to it, because Geller had actually been tested by a PhD experimental psychologist, which is what I was training to become. So I figured, well, those guys are smarter than me. There must be something to it. And then I saw the Amazing Randy on The Tonight Show showing that he could do everything the so-called psychics were doing, and I realized, whoa, okay, there's something else going on here, like intentional deception or something like that, that white rats don't do, but people do. And so that sort of led me into looking into it more. And you know, long story short, after I got my PhD and I was teaching college and I just started the skeptics thing. It was just sort of a hobby in my garage. It was just for fun. All I ever wanted to do was be a college professor. But this kind of took on a life of its own, and it became a way to understand how science works by looking on the borderlands, sort of like what you do. It's a way of looking at interesting experiences that people really have. I never deny the experiences that people have. They're very real, and they're very powerful. And to me, the area of psychology that's most interesting is this area of why people have these odd, unusual, interesting experiences and what they really represent.
Okay, well, both of you, we'll be back with you in just a moment, and we'll take final phone calls. I'll also have the results of the fast blast poll. Say that 10 times, Stanton.
No, thank you.
And, Stanton, we'll get you back on your latest work. What's new on the Walter Haut affidavit, Stanton? Anything?
Well, there's been a lot of discussion about just how the affidavit was created, whether Walter dictated something, whether he handwrote something, whether this is a compilation of comments that he's made over the years. So that one's still up in my gray basket. I was the first to talk to Walter. Had the greatest respect for the man as an individual. How much of this reflects reality? I'm looking for the evidence that General Ramey and Colonel DuBose actually were over in Roswell. We're looking for flight logs and things like that. That would be a big step.
Okay, stay with us. By the way, another story out for you. You should know about a toymaker, Fisher-Price, recalling 83 types of toys, including the popular Big Bird, Elmo, Dora, and Diego characters, because their paint contains excessive amounts of lead. It is a worldwide recall of 1 million preschool toys made by a Chinese company. Here we go again. We'll be back. Okay, welcome back to Coast. Let's go to final calls now. Wildcard Line, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, this is Sean coming to you from the MySpace Coast to Coast chat.
Hey, Sean, good to have you with us.
Hey, thanks a lot, George. Great show tonight. And my question is to Michael, as he mentioned about a U.S. military craft being tested many years ago. I can't quite remember the name, but he sarcastically compared it to UFO encounters. Well, my question to you, Michael, is why would you think that, let's say, for example, the Chicago O'Hara incident, November 7, 2006, how could that be military tested? Why would they want to test that in such a diverse, publicly placed?
Well, first of all, not everything is a military aircraft, just like not all explanations are swamp gas or the planet Venus. I mean, these are, you know, lots and lots of different, thousands of different sightings, and they're going to have lots of different explanations, and Stan and I are already in agreement that the majority of them are explainable by natural means of various kinds. So I only use the military aircraft as just one example among many.
What about Chicago, though? What would you say about that? Would you say
I don't know. I've just never had the time to track that one down. I don't even remember what the official explanation.
You're a professional here. I want to know your personal opinion about this. Chicago O'Hara, what's your take on it?
I don't know. I haven't.
You have no idea.
I haven't looked into it, no.
Okay. What about Stan? What about you?
Well, I should make the audience aware that the NARCAP, National Aviation Reporting Center for Anomalous Phenomena, you didn't hear the word UFO in there, has just issued its 152-page report by Dr. Richard Haynes, a retired NASA scientist, who has done an exhaustive investigation of what happened at O'Hare on November 7th, 2006. This was the case that was covered by the Chicago Tribune on January 1st. And about a dozen or so United Airlines employees, none of whom would let their names be used, but with whom Richard has spoken and the reporter for the Chicago Tribune has spoken, described this round object sitting, the sighting lasted, let's say, roughly 15 minutes. And when these round objects sitting over the United Airlines terminal at O'Hare, under 1,900 feet, because we know where the ceiling was, when it took off almost straight up, it sort of drilled a hole in the clouds that lasted for a little while, a most remarkable event. And NARCAP's concern about this is that it's a threat to airline safety. If you got something over O'Hare Airport, and I'm sure there are other witnesses who haven't come forward, but this is one of many cases involving pilots. They've got more than 3,000 on file. And Dr. Haynes, as I say, worked for NASA Ames Laboratory there in California. So it's an excellent case, nothing remarkable in the sense no aliens were observed. It didn't crash. We don't have pieces of it. There was a lie from the FAA, which was corrected when Dick managed to get the under Freedom of Information or radar stuff and radio communications. Exciting case. You'll be hearing more about it. This just came out a couple of days ago. And so a very good case, multiple witness. Daytime, peculiar behavior, a round object sitting still over O'Hare Airport seen by United Airlines employees. Good case.
Okay, well, I appreciate it, George. I tip my hat to you, Stan, and you, George, and for you, Michael, my opinion and many others. I would say open your mind a little bit more. All right, take care, guys.
Okay, Sean. West of the Rockies, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, am I on?
Yes, sir. It's all you.
Yes, Stanton, I had a couple questions I wanted to ask you.
Okay.
First of all, I know the alien thing's been talked to death, but I've heard many times and, you know, read a lot up on the Hollow Earth theory, and that was one of the things they said was the biggest cover-up that was going on within the States is the fact that there is an actual Hollow Earth and intelligent beings living there, and a lot of the UFOs we're seeing are coming from within our own Earth.
I tried to track down those stories, and there are stories, especially involving Admiral Byrd supposedly going in at the hole at the pole. I talked to the man who was his pilot on all his polar expeditions. He said it never happened. He did throw in one caveat, namely that it was now public knowledge that occasionally Byrd drank too much, and so who could say, you know, what he might have said under certain conditions. But I can find no basis for that. Our satellites would be affected by the change in gravity from having a hole at the poles. I can find no substance to substantiate Hollow Earth.
Okay. The other thing I wanted to mention was that have you ever heard of a fellow named Phil Snyder?
The late Phil Snyder, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, the late Phil Snyder. I've heard of him. He's at best in my gray basket. I haven't heard anything convincing about him either. There are a lot of stories out there about...
Yeah, well, I don't know if you've watched his videos that he had recorded.
No, I haven't.
Oh, well, I've got these videos, and they're very rare and very hard to find, but he gives a three-hour lecture about everything from the bases that he worked on. And then,
yeah, there's one on YouTube, I think.
Yeah, well, the ones I got, I ended up purchasing off eBay, but they were in amongst a whole bunch of DVDs, and in this he talks about there's 132 bases in the United States underground, some of which are 22 miles in length, and also that there's tunnels connecting all these bases right up into Mexico and stuff, and these trains are shooting across these tunnels at Mach 2.
Well, that's an exciting story, but I haven't yet seen any bases for it. I will agree that there are some underground bases for two good reasons, hide from satellites and to... in case there's a nuclear weapons exchange, which, after all, was considered a real possibility not too many years ago. But I have seen nothing to substantiate those claims, so I wouldn't buy them until I see far more. And Gray Basket is being generous, I think, on that one.
Well, let's go to East of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Good morning.
Good morning. My wife and I saw, you know, we were people that just were big doubters. We saw a UFO with other people. In the year 2000, right in that year somewhere, we were returning from dinner one night, and, you know, we had no, we thought perhaps there's people from other planets, you know, we never had any proof, but we looked above us as the cars in front of us started to stop, and continue traveling. We were returning from dinner one night, and, I looked up and I saw about 150 feet above me, about 150 feet in diameter, a large circular air vehicle. I mean, you know, the first thing came to my mind, and I believe the human mind is programmed with your limited resources to say, you know, this must be a helicopter. It was late in the evening. All I could see was some lights around it, and cars were stopping and starting ahead of us. And so I said, well, I rolled down the window, looked up, and there was no helicopter blade noise. Then I said, perhaps a blimp. But this thing was really large and circular, and I would think the lights around it would be around a square cabin. So there was just complete silence. It never moved. And we were traveling about 45 miles an hour to begin with, and I kept having to reset cruise control, and I kept stopping and starting. It was annoying. And so came to the conclusion, as you do, your mind is programmed. You know, there's no explanation, finally. There's no explanation for this stationary object, probably about 200 feet from the Atlantic Ocean, riding along Ormond Beach's Tomoka Park area on Ocean Boulevard, A1A. And I got home, and I called 911. Now, I just suspect our experience with all these other people in front of us in traffic, stopping and starting and looking up, it's just so typical. Your mind is programmed to think, you know, it has to be this, it has to be that. Pretty soon you eliminate the has to be's and you say there's no explanation. Called 911, left that information, looked in the papers the next day, nothing came of it. And but, you know, all these people, I'd say 6, 7, 10 ahead of us in traffic, traveling at about 45 miles an hour, stopping and starting, all looking up, we all experienced the same thing. But no, you know, no report of it, and to this day, no explanation. Now, I personally believe now, after witnessing this with these other people and my wife, there are other life in the universe. But I think more specifically, the reason all these debunkers have a problem with life in the universe is the simple fact the physiology of life as we know it could not travel these great distances. Now, what I personally believe, there aren't great distances. I believe this life exists, and it'll be the biggest surprise to everyone, right within our solar system. And I believe on perhaps the moon Titan, perhaps Venus underground where the temperatures are more comfortable, there is a life form in visiting us, and we just have no idea that it's right within our solar system. And the reason I believe it has to be in our solar system is life is so diverse in size, from the bacteria under the microscope to the size of everything through the telescope, that life would have to be about the same size as us and our portion of the universe. It's just something that would have to be compatible with our size. If you went under the microscope...
Okay, let's grab a question, though, because the clock's going to get us here.
I just believe, is it a possibility that the mind, you know, is limited and is programmed to believe if you see something, it has to be X, Y, or Z, and it can't be an you don't have an opportunity to suggest anything else until later on you realize there's no other explanation. That's what happened to us.
And a question? Or just
the question
comment?
Is, do you think the human mind is programmed, and this is one of our problems, we have limited ability to understand anything other than what we know already.
Stanton, go ahead.
I don't think so. I think one of the things remarkable about Dr. James E. McDonald, the finest ufologist ever, in his congressional testimony, is he proposed a whole bunch of different possibilities for what these things were. He came up with the extraterrestrial hypothesis as the least unlikely. Now, I certainly object to the notion that you can't get here from there, that the body can't handle it. It only takes a year at 1G to get close to the speed of light. And remember, Einstein not only said the speed of light was a limit, but as you get close to it, time slows down for things moving that fast, which is the craziest thing we've said all night, but is true, has been experimentally measured, so it's no big deal. I'm not saying there aren't other forms of life, but the escalation of hypothesis that the caller described is standard practice. Oh, it must be a helicopter. Oh, maybe it's a Piper Cub, or it's a blimp. And then pretty soon you get to the point, whoops, he didn't say how what he saw left, but if it zips off at very high speed after sitting still and against the wind, let's say, then you're stuck. What am I going to do to explain this? So that's part of the problem, but most sightings don't get reported. I check my audiences. 10% have had a sighting. 90% of them didn't report what they saw. So it's not unusual for a whole bunch of people to see something and there be nothing in the paper next day.
Let's go now to our wild card line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello. My name is Richard. I'm from Kansas. And this is directed at Michael Shermer.
Okay, Richard.
Out of his books, recently read the book, The Science of Good and Evil. And my question concerns the subject of divine right, pages 34 through 36 of his book. I find that people, like in ancient history, when people could believe in powerful, nebulous things from, you know, which they had no evidence for, it gave power to, you know, the god kings and all that. And I see this kind of surfacing nowadays in these beliefs for which there is no empirical evidence. And I'm not saying that some of these things aren't true. I'm just saying that there is no evidence. And empirical evidence means everything. And so I would be asking, I guess, Michael Shermer, if he thinks that this power that comes from convincing the masses that a strange belief is true kind of plays a role in what is going on in the UFO field and in many other fields. And
yeah,
that's all I have to
say. I think you're speaking truth to power there, as they used to say, in a very literal sense, that political leaders have always used whatever means they can to hold on to power, increase power. And so I'm even more cynical than, say, someone like Dawkins about religion. He's cynical about religion itself. I'm not. I think politicians have simply used religion as a tool for making us even more tribal than we already are, such that even if there was no religion, we'd still be just as tribal and find other reasons to hate one another. Groups would, that is. And so, you know, I do think that's, you know, it's pretty obvious in history that's what politicians have done.
Okay, well, the results of the fast plats are in, and it's 80% to 20%. Stanton Friedman received 80%. Michael Shermer, 20. Reaction, Michael?
Shocked. Completely shocked. I was robbed. It was fixed.
And
it's a cabal.
It is a accuracy rate of plus or minus 5%.
Really that high accuracy?
Stanton, 80% this time.
Well, I'm very pleased, I guess, and I'm glad to know there are a lot of fans out there. And that is a pretty decent reflection in my lecturing all over the place. And I find that I've only had 11 hecklers in over 700 lectures.
And this audience, though, tends to be a believing audience.
Of course it does.
Yeah.
And I'm not, I'm just going to say this is a selected audience, of course, just as Susan Clancy selected who she thought of as abductees. But I'm not surprised by the results, really, because, as I say, of my experience out on the hustings there, 11 hecklers, two of whom were drunk, out of over 700 lectures, tells you that, hey, most people are ready, willing, and able to accept facts, data, solid information. That's what I provide.
Okay, we'll take one or two more calls. That'll be it. First-time caller line. Go ahead, please.
I'm driving. My name's Rob. I'm driving a truck outside of Louisville, Kentucky.
Uh-huh.
And my question is to any of you, really, if you ever heard of any evidence or do you know of the people who have been abducted or have seen these sightings of UFOs, what their particular religious preferences might be? How many of them are Muslim? How many are Hindus? How many are Christians?
Do we have that breakdown, Stanton, other than...
I don't know of any such breakdown. I know some people have looked into the effect of race and age and stuff like that, but we have a very incomplete data set. You know, go to my website and send me your report, but I don't know of a good breakdown. Maybe Michael does, but I certainly don't.
Nope, I don't think there's been any.
Not at all.
Like that. No.
Both of you can take 30 seconds for summation. Michael?
Oh, well.
And I mean again, 30.
In science, science is conservative by nature because there are so many extraordinary claims that are made, most of which turn out to be wrong. So we do have to be cautious. We do need to have really solid evidence, not just anecdotal evidence. Anecdotes don't make a science. They make the start of a research program. But in the end, we really need a body, in this case, a spacecraft, an instrument, an alien life form, something like that. And then we'd all, of course, completely accept it.
That's our 30. And Stanton, you won 80%. That's enough of a summation for you.
Well, it's a very good summation. And I will say that we've got enormous amounts of evidence. I wish more people, and especially former military people, would come forward with them, with their stories about pilots lost to UFOs, stuff like that.
All right, my friends, both of you, thank you for being in the skeptic's cage. Two went in. Stanton Friedman came out. For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, Alan Corbett, Stephanie Smith, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.